And this is KZSU, Stanford University. My name is Dave Levine, and welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, a show designed to focus on the intersection of law and technology, but not necessarily from a lawyer's perspective and not necessarily from a techie or geek's perspective. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and in continuing the trend that I've tried to establish of interviewing the great people that are connected in one way or another with CIS, today I'm very pleased to have as a guest Colin Rule, the Director of Online Dispute Resolution at eBay. Among Colin's many accolades and many roles is a non-resident fellow at CIS, where he has been blogging. I was actually talking to him right before we started the show here today and commenting on his great blog. But I will allow Colin to more fully introduce himself once we begin the interview. Today's discussion is an area that is of increasing importance, not only in the technology field, but also in the law field, and really in any field where people or entities or people with divergent interests interact, and that's the world of dispute resolution. Colin Rule is, as the Director of Online Dispute Resolution at eBay, is tasked with the immense job of handling all online dispute resolution at eBay. And today's discussion really is going to be a focus on what the world of online dispute resolution, or the acronym I think we'll be using today is ODR, is all about. And taking a look at it both from the perspective of one who is working directly on these types of disputes when you purchase or sell an item on eBay, but also the broader field itself and where the field is going and what the trends are and how technology interacts with those things. So today's discussion will be pretty far-ranging and I think will allow us to get a better idea on this burgeoning world. As an attorney myself and someone that litigated for a number of years before coming to Stanford, I always had kind of mixed opinions of dispute resolution generally, because sometimes it amounted in what, you know, basically amounted to just splitting the difference, and there was often concerns from a lawyer's perspective that rules of evidence were not being employed, which both hinders and helps depending on what you're trying to do. Mediation, arbitration, these other forms of non-court, non-litigation related dispute resolution often have benefits when it comes to trying to settle a case before having to employ those expenses, and oftentimes the results are more favorable for both sides than they would be in court. So it's really one of those interesting areas where, while there's a lot of criticism, there's also a tremendous amount of interest in the field, and it really has a lot of benefits. In the world of technology in particular, and at a place like eBay, where people are interacting on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis, and buying and selling items, of course, the disputes multiply in numbers that I'll be chatting a bit with Colin about, but I'm sure are huge. And you have a whole myriad of issues that go along with trying to figure out how to solve those problems. So I'm looking forward to this discussion, to really exploring the issues in a thorough perspective with one of the real experts in the field. So let's go into a little more music, and when we come back, we'll talk to Colin. And I'm here with Colin. Colin, thank you for coming today.
Hey, Dave. Glad to be here with you.
Terrific. I've tried to pick some songs that have some degree of discussion of at least conflict between people. So the songs themselves, which are not heard on the podcast, but will be heard today on KZSU, this show is being pre-recorded, kind of touch on this whole issue of how to solve problems between people. Why don't you do a much better job than me in introducing yourself and what you do and how you got into this field and your background?
Sure. Well, actually, I thought you did a great job. And that song, I was just listening to the lyrics going, wow, this could be the theme song of eBay dispute resolution. Yeah, people regretting the things that they said,
right.
Only having their expression to defend themselves. But so you actually hit the nail right on the head. I mean, at eBay, we have lots and lots of people buying and selling from each other all over the world, more than 200 million users at last count. So disputes arise. Disputes are inevitable. And buyers and sellers have problems, and it's in eBay's interest to help them work it out the best that we can. So We provide a lot of different tools and techniques and support to try and help our buyers and sellers work out their problems, and we're actually pretty successful doing it.
What are the range of ways that you have to deal with these issues? In other words, first of all, just for listeners that aren't familiar with eBay, although I think there's probably fewer and fewer people on the planet that would be,
right.
Describe very basically what the typical eBay transaction is,
sure.
And then where do disputes come up?
Well, eBay is the world's largest marketplace. So essentially the way that most people know eBay is as an auction site. So if you've got something that you want to sell in your garage, you can list it on eBay, and you can essentially start an auction that will run for a certain amount of time. And different people who are interested in that item can come across it and place bids. And the person who has the highest bid at the point when the time runs out wins. Now, there are other ways to get items on eBay. There's something that we call buy it now, which is more like, here's a price, I want to pay the price, then you pay it. But what essentially that means is people from all over the world get access to that item that you may be selling out of your garage, and that's a new capacity. We never really had that capability before. Marketplaces were very geographically bound, so if you were selling a chest of drawers in Hershey, Pennsylvania, pretty much the only people who are going to see it are the people who are in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Well, now you can put it up on eBay and people from all over the world can see it. So the good thing is the vast, vast majority of those transactions work out just fine. But in a small slice of them, problems can arise. And the vast majority of the time, it's misunderstandings or miscommunications between buyers and sellers. But because these people who are engaging in these transactions are most often strangers, they don't really have a reservoir of trust between them that they can use to resolve a difficulty when it arises. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for misunderstandings to erupt, and that's what we do is try and facilitate communication between the buyer and seller to get problems resolved as early as possible.
Do you have without going chapter and verse, roughly how many disputes occur in a given week or a given month when it comes to these kinds of sales?
Yeah, we do millions of disputes a year. And I'm actually spending most of my time now on the PayPal side, which is eBay's payment arm. But between eBay and PayPal, we do tens of millions of disputes. So it's a lot, and that's all over the world in 16 different languages, because eBay has big sites in China and India and all over Europe, and partner sites in Latin America and Australia. So we're dealing with a lot of cross-cultural disputes, a lot of language issues, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong in terms of international shipping and things like that. So there's a lot of complexity to deal with.
So it's not just disputes involving I set a price and I didn't get paid. It goes the range from arguments about the price to what the item actually is,
right,
to how it was shipped. I mean, it runs the gamut of all forms of basically commerce that one would possibly be involved in.
Well, the beauty of having this many disputes is we do see the same issues arise again and again. So we can build processes that focus on specific types of disputes. So in terms of the three big buckets that we wrestle with, the number one in terms of volume is what we call unpaid item disputes, which is where a buyer commits to buy something from a seller, but they never follow through and pay. And those aren't that serious because the seller isn't going to ship the item until they actually get paid. So usually it's more of an inconvenience. The seller needs to get the fees that they paid eBay back because the buyer didn't follow through on the transaction. But then we also have what we call item not received disputes, which is where the buyer pays and the seller never sends it. That's more serious because the buyer's out their money. Or significantly not as described disputes, where the buyer thinks that they're getting, for instance, a Pentium 4 laptop, and it shows up and it's a 486 laptop. So what they thought they were getting is different than what they got. So those disputes are more complex, a little more serious, because the buyer's out their money. But those three big buckets are the vast majority of the disputes we wrestle with on the site. But there are other matters as well, like feedback disputes that arise, and we have different techniques for dealing with those as well. But one thing that's true, because I've been in the dispute resolution field for, almost 15 years at this point, and every dispute, no matter how small the amount of money that may be involved, it's like a snowflake. There's infinite complexity depending on the personalities of the people involved. So it doesn't make these disputes any easier to resolve that they're over relatively small amounts of money.
You mentioned your background. I want to just delve into that briefly. You know, a lot of people, when they think of this kind of field, they would assume that one is an attorney because you're dealing with disputes.
Absolutely.
But you are not. And,
that's right.
You know, and so how did you wind up, first of all, is the attorney aspect something that's almost a misconception about what dispute resolution is? And then secondly, how did you get into this field?
Well, it's an interesting controversy within the dispute resolution field right now. I'm one of the co-coordinators of the online dispute resolution committee of the dispute resolution section of the American Bar Association.
Huh.
And pretty much everybody presumes that any member of the ABA is a lawyer. But it turns out the two people who are coordinating this committee, neither of us are lawyers. So we fall into a bucket, NLM, which is non-lawyer mediators.
Huh.
But there is a lot of controversy right now within the dispute resolution field about what credentials should we use to say someone is certified as a dispute resolution professional. And, of course, the legal field is ready right there to say, well, we already have a certification process in place, and some states have leaned in the direction of saying, well, you have to be a lawyer to be a mediator or an arbitrator. And those of us who are non-lawyer mediators, you know, we get very paranoid when we hear rumblings like that. I've been in the dispute resolution field, as I said, for a very long time. And early on, I remember talking to people at the National Institute for Dispute Resolution in Washington, which was my first job out of college, and saying, do I need to be a lawyer to do this? And they said, no, you don't. You know, you can be in any field. So my interest was in public policy. So I have a degree in public policy, and I focused on conflict resolution there. And most of the people in the public policy, what we call environmental or public policy dispute resolution, are not lawyers.
Huh.
They're scientists or facilitators. Some people are lawyers. They call themselves reformed lawyers. But in other areas of practice, it's much more helpful to be a lawyer if you're dealing with intellectual property or something like that. A huge area in dispute resolution right now is family dispute resolution, and many of those people are counselors or social workers. So there's many, many people that are drawn into the field, and the controversy is how much – some people even feel it to be a disadvantage for a lawyer to be a mediator, because we have what lawyers have what some refer to as the litigation mindset,
mm-hmm.
which is I'm going to be an advocate for this person. You know, let's fight it out, you know. Conflict or putting the two people head to head, we're going to come out with the best outcome. Whereas that's anathema to much dispute resolution practice, which is less about advocating for one side or the other and trying to generate conflict between two different perspectives. It's more about trying to find, you know, the middle ground, find the underlying issues that are causing the dispute and then try to resolve them. So it's definitely a hot issue within the field, and I would say it's still unresolved.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area, and obviously there's so much to discuss in a limited amount of time.
Sure.
I studied industrial labor relations as an undergrad, and I took a number of courses in arbitration, either arbitration or negotiation, but the different, you know, management labor type issues that you deal with. And as I think about it now, the people that I studied with as professors were not attorneys either.
Right.
There was a great professor named Jim Gross who was a AAA arbitrator for a number of years, who was also a minor league baseball player too. He was an interesting guy, but he wasn't an attorney. At least I don't think he was. Sam Bacharach is another professor who's been at Cornell for a long time studying
sure.
workplace issues and drug use in the workplace and other things like that. But I took a great course with him called Power and Bargaining or Power and Negotiation.
Oh, yeah.
Which was outstanding, and these were not attorneys, and yet these were people who were focusing in one form or another entirely on issues of how to make sure that people continue to work and how to resolve disputes. So it sounds to me, and it's interesting, I think, that the presumption that you would want to have that legal background really is not necessary at all.
Right.
Do you find that there's any impediments to moving into the field of dispute resolution if you want to be a mediator or an arbitrator without that legal background? It sounds like the answer is maybe no to that too.
Well, it's actually challenging to get involved with the field no matter what your background. I find it's a lot better to have an expertise area, and many lawyers in the course of their practice do get expertise in a certain type of dispute, and that can be very valuable because they have connections that can get them into a position where they can receive those referrals. As I said before, I worked at the National Institute for Dispute Resolution, and I used to get all of the outside information requests. And every day I would get five or six calls from lawyers who were miserable in some firm writing the same contract every day for 10 years. And they said, you know, the reason why I got into this field was because I wanted to help people work out their problems. And I don't feel like I'm doing that. I feel like I'm just part of a ground war, you know, sort of a war of attrition between these two large companies that are spending lots of money trying to outlast each other. And it's often hard for even those lawyers who have that background, that expertise, to get into the conflict resolution field. The most important thing to do is to get a training. Usually there are 40-hour certified dispute resolution trainings all over the country. And a good place to learn about them is the Association for Conflict Resolution. Their website is acrnet.org. Okay. And then you can usually get referrals. There's usually an internship process. I did court-connected mediation through a dispute resolution training I did back in Boston. And that was really the first chance I had to deal with legal disputes between strangers. I had done conflict resolution in a college context, which is very interesting as well. But there's lots of ways to get involved with local community mediation centers, and then just get some experience. And slowly but surely, as your skill builds as a mediator, you'll find new opportunities, new things you can move into. But you know, online dispute resolution is a very interesting wing of the field. I was always a geek. I love technology. So I wanted to find a synthesis between technology and dispute resolution, and this sort of new wing of the field emerged. And I said, boy, there's going to be disputes over there too. And as it turns out, there are lots and lots. So that's what I would advise to people who are looking to get involved in the field. Get trained, try and find some cases where you can get mentored and build your skills, and then just look around and try and find where disputes may exist, and then get yourself in a position where you can help out.
It sounds like good advice, and I think it moves us into an area that I want to explore today, which really is the world of resolution generally. How does a dispute get resolved in the broad sense? In other words, what kind of tasks do you need to undertake, both at eBay but also generally,
sure,
to resolve a conflict? If there was a bullet point of three or four main criteria that you need to employ, what would they be? And then does that wind up moving you into court or into another form of mediation?
Sure.
or do you solve the problem at that point?
Well, you know, there's always a phenomenon where people have a hammer, so everything looks like a nail. So it's easy when you first get trained to say, wow, this is a great mechanism. And there are many different ways that people engage in conflict resolution. But once you get trained in a certain paradigm, people will say, okay, great, I'm going to use this paradigm over and over again. I'm going to use this in my family conflicts. I'm going to use this in my workplace conflicts. And it doesn't always work that way. Usually, conflict resolution is about having a toolbox of techniques and processes that you can use and designing appropriate systems for helping to work out problems in an ongoing way. So, for instance, in the eBay context, like I said, we're dealing mostly with buyer-seller disputes over relatively small amounts of money between strangers, people who've never met and probably who never will meet. Well, that's a very particular kind of conflict. People don't have relationships that you can work off of, and they're not interested in investing the time and energy to really build a relationship that can last into the future. You mentioned before the ILR program, mm-hmm, that you were involved with. Labor management situations are very different. Oftentimes you have a situation where there's already a lot of suspicion between labor and management in a particular company. There may be a history, a long history, and it's important that these two bodies build a relationship that can work moving forward. So the type of dispute resolution that you would employ in an eBay context between strangers is very different than the type of dispute resolution you would employ in a labor management negotiation, which is different than what you'd use in a family dispute where you have a husband and wife and they're probably trying to figure out custody issues, or an environmental dispute where you may have a polluted river and lots of different communities and businesses and governmental organizations, all of whom are invested in cleaning it up. So I don't want to get too relativistic here and
right,
say there's no, you know, but I think mostly what we do in the dispute resolution field is we try and focus people on the core issues that make up the conflict, and focus on moving towards solutions, and try and get people past some of the, I think it's just human nature, to sort of accusations and the belief that the other side is evil, and zero-sum thinking, where anything that I win is your loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually not the case in almost every kind of dispute. There are what we call integrative outcomes, where both sides can get essentially what they need and work out the problem so that you can move past it.
So it's a false criticism that that ultimately what a lot of dispute resolution winds up in is simply just splitting down the middle.
That's right.
You know, because that's always been a criticism, as I mentioned in the introduction, that I've heard from people about any form of dispute resolution.
Well, and not to be too accusatory here, Dave, but I know you're a lawyer.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, lawyers often have that attitude. It's like, you know, I can compromise at any point, but I don't want to compromise.
Right.
You know, I want to fight. I want to win. And dispute resolution is not about compromise. I mean, people often joke that dispute resolution says compromise is a dirty word. Uh-huh. And sometimes compromise is important. If you're dealing with just a monetary amount, you know, it's zero sum. Either you're going to get the dollar or I'm going to get the dollar. But there's usually other things that matter. And you can factor those things in and come up with an outcome that maybe it's not a complete victory for both sides, but it's better than just a straight, you know, division of resources between one side and the other. And there is, I think, the judicial or legal education inculcates in young minds, young JDs, the vision that this is the way to resolve a dispute. We have designed this system. It's been refined over hundreds of years. So put a dispute in here, and you're going to get the right outcome. You're going to get a fair outcome. And for a lot of people, that's not the case. The court process, the judicial process, in and of itself, can be destructive to the goals that people have.
Right.
And I think family mediation is a great example of that. Pretty much everybody involved know that if you're going to go into court and have a divorce, that's going to be ugly. And your relationship is probably not going to come out the other side stronger than it did going in. Where if you have a mediation process, types of things like custody, which is very difficult for a judge to render a decision and say, here's a fair outcome for custody that's going to be workable over the long term, you've got to achieve that by consensus. You've mm-hmm. got – both sides need to be bought in. And you don't want to decide that in a battle-type environment where you've got lawyers accusing everything under the sun, you know, in both directions. So I guess my strategy, what I say is, let a thousand flowers bloom. I think there are many disputes that belong in court. For instance, you can't mediate a criminal matter.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to negotiate with someone who's a criminal. So fair enough. I think it's funny, in our society, we have the judicial process and then we have everything else. And everything else falls into the bucket of alternative dispute resolution. It's an alternative to the judicial process.
Right.
So there are hundreds of techniques out there, and all of them should be considered. And probably they all have applications that are appropriate to certain conflict situations.
My, of course, being the provocative interviewer that I attempt to be.
Bring it on.
Yes, I'm bringing it on. And I don't mean to suggest, of course, that my personal opinion is that it's always that way.
Right.
I think I found in my own practice and my own experience with it that was, in fact, a false criticism. And I actually found in a couple of mediations that I was involved with, both one was labor and one was just a commercial dispute,
sure,
that there's no question in my mind that if we had gone the straight litigation route, both sides would have spent a lot more money than necessary and gotten a worse outcome for both of them.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm in agreement with that. But I'm curious, one of the points you made earlier about eBay and the fact that people don't have the personal relationships, how much of those other factors that you described – it seems to me that often in negotiation you have these intangibles, like, I want an apology.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it's not because there's no monetary value to it. It's something intrinsic. Or I like that person and I want to – and that's – having a relationship with someone that I like or someone that I want to deal with again is more important to me than the current dispute and what the outcome is.
Sure.
How in moving into the technology realm, and we can discuss this more after a music break, but I want to kind of start the conversation. How does technology help or hinder that kind of analysis? If you're dealing with two, you know, for purposes of eBay, relatively inanimate objects, people that are writing emails,
right,
or maybe now with newer technology, they might have spoken, but for the most part, at least a traditional eBay transaction, I imagine, would have been one of interacting through the website.
Absolutely.
How do you figure those intangible characteristics into an online dispute resolution?
Well, that's a very complicated question. Actually, part of the revolutionary aspect of online dispute resolution is that most communication is textual, as you mentioned, and that very much changes the communication dynamic between the two parties. In eBay, it's interesting. There are many things that we rely on when we meet somebody face-to-face, when we get a bead on them. When you walk into a room with someone you've never met, you look them over, you hear the way they speak, there's a lot of nonverbal cues that you use to determine how you're going to react to that individual. Online, you don't have a lot of those cues. So eBay has created some things that act as a proxy, in a sense. And one of the big inventions is the feedback system, where you can look at someone's transaction history and see all the comments from everyone that they've engaged in transactions with. And on eBay, that often becomes a very important way to gauge the trustworthiness of the person that you're interacting with. So there are analogs online to some of that nonverbal information that you get before you even interact with someone. But then once you start communicating with them textually, again, you read a lot into language, into the words that they put in an email to you or a chat message to you. And it's very interesting to see the way that people engage in negotiation and engage in consensus building when they're exclusively interacting through text. Sometimes it's a plus that you're interacting through text because you've got a record there. You can be very clear. You can actually copy and paste someone's words and say you said what you were looking for was quote, paste, quote. And that's very hard to do in a face-to-face interaction. The goalposts will move in a face-to-face interaction because I didn't say that. That's not what I meant. Whereas online, you have more of a record. But also there's vulnerabilities. I mean, people can say something sarcastically and that sarcasm does not come through in text and it can be interpreted very aggressively. So, one thing that I see all the time in eBay disputes is someone will come in and immediately post a very aggressive message. Where's my item? Whereas if you were to meet this person, some stranger, you would not walk right up to them and say that. Right. You'd say, hi, my name's so-and-so. We engaged in this transaction, and I see you're from Wiscogee. Oh, that's great. I have a cousin there. You'd engage in some rapport building. Online, people are much more task-oriented, and that leads people oftentimes to be much more aggressive, or at least to come off much more aggressively. And what you'll see is someone will come in and make an aggressive statement, the other person will bristle, and then the first person will backpedal a little bit and go, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to, I apologize, once they get the piece of information that it's on its way and here's the tracking number, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So exploring the dynamics of online interaction is one of the most interesting things that I've done over the course of my involvement with online dispute resolution and being at eBay and being able to read thousands and thousands of these message threads and see what works and what doesn't. It's taught me a lot about how people work out their problems.
I'm sure it does, and it probably makes you probably one of the best communicators on the internet that's out there, or at least seeing the tools, because I've found for myself that I always abhorred the smiley. I always thought it was goofy and silly, and why would I do that? And then I had a couple of interactions just like that, where at what you're describing, where I said something either sarcastically or I meant a joke,
right,
and the person didn't know me well enough, or maybe it just didn't sound like a joke because I didn't make it clear. But either way, the response I got was one of concern or offense, and I realized, and I had to, of course, write back and say I was just kidding, but the impression is made. Now what I do, and maybe I should just learn to write better, but at least when I do something like this, I'll put a smiley in, which comes, the goofy, colon and parentheses, but it seems to resolve a lot of those concerns.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people rely on that for tone. You need tone everywhere.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let's take a short music break, and kind of when we come back, I want to talk about disputes that might not be suitable for ADR and focus even more on how the internet dispute resolution field is going and what the trends are and things like that. So you're listening to KZSU Stanford University, and when we return, we'll continue the discussion. Truly one of the most brutal albums to come out in 2006, but also brilliant. That's John Auer off Songs from the Year of Our Demise, and the song Four Letter Word, something we can't say on the radio. But before we get back to Colin, I just wanted to point out that I hope you enjoy what you're hearing. And I'd like to ask you to help make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials to listeners all over the Bay Area. You can donate to KZSU. For more information, email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.org or call us at 650-723-9010. And don't forget, of course, to keep on listening. So we're back with Colin, and I've picked songs that deal with these extremely, I mean, of course, that album deals with divorce, which fortunately I don't think you're dealing with too much on eBay.
No, I was saying that really does highlight the family mediator challenge there. I treat your name like a four-letter word.
Yeah. It's pretty tough, but a theme album nonetheless. Yeah. And the theme, of course, is that dispute. Let's talk more about internet services in particular. There are other forms of internet services that allow this dispute resolution. And,
sure.
And I've read about programs and services where people actually submit blind offers back and forth to a third party.
Sure.
Like, very much like mediation, except it's done through the internet. What's your impression of those types of services, and how are they changing the ADR/ODR world?
Well, you raise a very good point. You know, before you were talking about kind of how textual communication changes the dispute resolution process. When I first got involved with online dispute resolution in the late 90s, pretty much what we were doing was using technology to replicate face-to-face interactions. So if in a face-to-face process we had unassisted storytelling and then assisted storytelling and then brainstorming and joint problem solving, then what we would do is we would build online mechanisms that did exactly the same thing in the same order. But what we quickly realized is that technology enables disputants and mediators to do things that are impractical, if not impossible, offline in a face-to-face environment. And one of the things that was invented, one of the early concepts, is something called the fourth party, which is there's a professor at University of Massachusetts named Ethan Katch, and who came up with this concept. And essentially it's that technology can do a lot of the things that mediators and arbitrators or impartial dispute resolution people, even judges, have done in the past, and in some senses do it much more efficiently. So instead of just replicating these face-to-face dispute resolution processes, well, why don't we invent new tools that can help people work out their problems? And one of those early tools is something called blind bidding. Or it's really an automated negotiation tool. So just for people who don't have any experience with it,
right.
One of the biggest companies is called CyberSettle, and they have a mechanism where two parties who are arguing over an amount of money, they can log into the website, and they can one side can put in three bids that they'd be willing to accept to settle the matter if either amounts of money that they are willing to pay or money that they are willing to receive. Then the other side can log in, and they can put in three bids too. So for bid number one, if the two bids are within a prescribed range that the two parties have agreed on, say 20-30%, then it settles for the midpoint between the bids. If they're not within that prescribed range, well, then it goes to bid two. And then it's compared, same thing. Bid three, compared, same thing. And now the reason why this is innovative, A, is because it takes no time to do this. Lawyers can go through, or insurance companies love this because they've got thousands, hundreds of thousands of cases they need to settle. So they'll go through and they'll price their cases, and they'll use a mechanism like this, and they'll work out 20% of their cases, which saves them millions and millions of dollars. But if you're a lawyer and you're about to go into trial and you want to know whether or not you have an amenable offer from the other side, but you don't want to tip your hand. You don't want to say, well, this is the amount of money that we're looking for. You can go use a mechanism like this, put in your three bids, and if the three bids don't work, if you don't settle, well, you haven't revealed any information to the other side. You've never said to the other side, this is the amount of money that we're looking for. So it's kind of a no-risk proposition for lawyers. And CyberSettle has had a lot of success deploying this mechanism out there and making it available to lawyers. And the American Trial Lawyers Association has signed on and said, this is a great, this is the official automated settlement tool of ATLA, of this organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, mechanisms like that, I think, have their place. But again, oftentimes disputes are about a lot more than money. And normally, if you're dealing with a family dispute, you may have monetary value issues, how much is my half of the house worth or something like that. You can use an automated negotiation mechanism like that to deal with that issue. But then if you also have non-monetary issues, you were talking before about principle.
Right.
I want an apology. Or how are we going to deal with custody? It's very difficult to deal with a dispute like that, which has a lot of moving parts, through an automated process.
Mm-hmm.
So, at eBay, we have automated processes we put together, not blind bidding, but more solution matching, and I can go into kind of how that works. Mm-hmm. But if that doesn't work for the parties, well, then they can go to a quasi-arbitration where a customer service representative from eBay or PayPal will look at a case and render a decision. Or they can go to some of our partners, some of our third-party partners like netneutrals.com or squaretrade.com, and they actually have live mediators that will work with the disputants to try and work out a problem. Hmm. So like I said, it's a toolbox, and these automated negotiation mechanisms are new tools that online dispute resolution has brought into the conflict resolution field. So conflict resolution professionals just need to know about them so that they can build systems to resolve their parties' disputes most effectively and utilize the tools that that are most applicable.
Yeah, what is that tool you mentioned there? What, expand on that, because that's fascinating. The tool that you described.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to deal with these intangibles. How does that work?
Are you talking about the CyberSettle one or the eBay?
Your eBay process.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, that's really. I ran my own company in Boston for 5 years before eBay called me up one day and said, "Gee, why don't you come out and talk to us about online dispute resolution?" But during my time at eBay and PayPal, I built really three big automated dispute resolution processes, fourth party, quote unquote, processes that are not run by individual people. They're software algorithms, but they try and optimize the chance that the buyer and seller are going to be able to communicate the key piece of information that's going to help them work out their problem. So, as an example, for instance, significantly not as described disputes are often very complicated. You can have two people, a buyer and a seller, who've engaged in the transaction in good faith, and they both have seen the same item, but the seller feels that it was accurately described in the original listing, and the buyer feels that it was not accurately described. And the challenge is these items oftentimes, they may be collectibles. There may be very few people in the world who have the expertise to truly determine the value of an item or the condition of an item, particularly for, you know, Hummel figurines or Beanie Babies. I mean, you know, there are people who know comic books, who know a lot about these types of items. So essentially the process that we put together at eBay and PayPal enables – these are buyer-reported problems. So the buyer is the one who feels the item is not as described. And they can come to eBay or PayPal and inform eBay or PayPal that they feel this way, and they create a dispute. And essentially we then create a space on the eBay or PayPal website where the buyer and seller can communicate directly with each other about the item. They can the seller could provide a partial refund. So say the item arrives and it's a Hummel figurine and it's a puppy and there's a crack in the paw. Mm-hmm. And the buyer says, "You told me that it was flawless and it's got a crack." And the seller says, I'm sorry, I didn't see the crack. Now you've sent me a digital photo of it, so I see that it's there. I think it lowers the value of this $500 figurine by $75, so I'm happy to provide you a partial refund of $75. Buyer says, "That's fine. That's great. I can either get it fixed for $75 or I feel that that's a more accurate price." They accept the partial refund. The dispute's closed. So there are lots and lots of ways that buyers and sellers can communicate directly with each other. Many, many disputes on the site have to do with item receipt. So the seller ships the item, but it hasn't arrived yet. And the buyer gets nervous, and they feel like, well, maybe the seller hasn't sent it. Well, we set up mechanisms that can enable the seller to provide tracking information to the buyer. We integrate those systems with third-party shipping websites like FedEx or UPS or USPS so that we can show exactly where the item is, when it's going to arrive. So by providing some of these technological tools, we can facilitate, essentially convene a conversation between the buyer and seller, and then try and capture the key piece of information that addresses the concern of the complainant in the situation and then get that matter resolved. And if they can't resolve it directly through direct communication, well, then the buyer, the complainant in the case of item not received or significantly not as described disputes, they can escalate that to a customer service representative who will then review the case and render a decision.
Hmm. So do you find in those types of disputes that you wish ever that you could just put them in a room physically and resolve it that way? Or I'm just wondering if there's a frustration level that you ever reach dealing with these disputes. Because as we've been talking about and as you mentioned,
sure,
people are communicating in a terse manner on the internet in ways that may put them off. Do you ever find or do you ever suggest that people actually physically meet? Is that, obviously you're dealing with the entire world
right.
in eBay, so that's obvious. I'm sure most of the time it isn't feasible. But is it ever something that crosses your mind, or something where, boy, you know, if they would just see each other, they could resolve it? I mean, how does that lack of human interaction impact you when you're down the brass tacks and you're trying to get it solved,
well,
and you think you're close?
Yeah, it's a very interesting issue. I remember very early on when I got involved with online dispute resolution, I went to a real giant in the field and told him, you know, I'm starting this company. It's going to focus on online dispute resolution. I'd like for you to be an advisor. He said, Colin, well, you know, I'll be your advisor because you've been a great employee and I respect you a lot, but this is a total waste of time because you – dispute resolution is about looking in somebody's eyes. It's about patting them on the back, that you're never going to be able to resolve any disputes when you don't have people in the same room. And I still very much respect this person. I mean, they're a giant in the field, but I think that this eBay experience and ODR writ large has proven them wrong. And I think part of the misconception is generational. This notion that the ideal interaction between two people is face-to-face, and anything short of that is going to be a less than satisfying experience. You know, I've been online my whole life. I started my first bulletin board when I was 10, and there have been periods of my life where I've preferred online interaction to face-to-face interaction. So the beauty of eBay is it's really all of the interaction that happens between people on eBay is online interaction. And most of the people who are heavy eBay users are very comfortable, and they come to prefer that. That's we just had our conference, eBay Live. We had 15,000 people out in Las Vegas. And it's great to meet, you know, these are my friends. I interact with them all the time. But when you see someone face-to-face, it's a little unnerving. You talk to them daily for a year online, you establish a different kind of relationship. And then when you meet them face-to-face, it's like, wow, okay, gee, I guess I don't really know you that well. But then you get back online and everybody, you know, you fall back into the old pattern. So I think that people are just as complex on either side of an online interaction as they are on both sides of a negotiating table. Mm-hmm. But I really do not encourage eBay members, if they have a problem and they can't work it out over email, to jump on a plane or get in a car and drive over to somebody's house. That almost never results in a resolved dispute. But I do encourage people to make the phone call. And we make phone numbers available between people who engage in a dispute. And many people do work out their problems over voice, whereas over email they're not able to do so. So, you know, I just think it's different. And I there's sort of an emerging digital eloquence that is occurring in our population as people's online lives become richer and richer. And I just happen to be one of the people who's lucky enough to have done that for the last 25 years. So I'm very comfortable online, and I actually prefer in many cases to mediate online than I do face-to-face, which I'm sure would burn the ears of most conflict resolution professionals, but that's just the way my practices evolve.
Well, I think in that answer you kind of epitomized what I mean by talking about hearsay culture and the fact that technology has changed our interaction. When I came up with the name, I was thinking of hearsay in the legal context, and hearsay, the basic definition, is a fact or a statement that you cannot offer in court for the truth of the assertion.
Sure.
The idea being that there's a credibility or whatever issue that causes the piece of information to be subject to doubt.
Absolutely.
As to its veracity. And we're in a society now because of, as you're mentioning, because of the richness and the increasing richness of life on the internet, and the fact that people are able to do more and more things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do by typing on a keyboard or conversing through the internet, we're in a culture where all of these disputes and all of these issues are going to increasingly, I think, be resolved on the internet. So it's encouraging to me to hear that someone that is focusing his career on this issue is not frustrated with where we are in terms of forcing us to take a step back and, in some ways, at least in a figurative sense, abandon the technology that we have.
Well, if you'll just allow me a minute to even
Please.
Go to a higher level of abstraction.
Sure, let's go. Let's go to the point that we're just in another plane.
That's
entirely.
Good. Wait. Let's see if I start speaking in tongues in a minute. But you know, I mean, eBay. When I look at it again, I'm not an MBA and I'm not a lawyer. My background's in public policy. And when I look at this company, we have 200 million plus users now, all over the world. If you counted those people up as citizens, we'd actually be the fifth largest country in the world. I think we just passed Brazil or something.
That's an amazing stat.
Yeah, so we got a ways to go before we get to China and India. But we're gunning for the United States, right? Uh-huh. I mean, we're still growing at quite an aggressive clip. So when I look at eBay, I often think about it in terms of a country. I mean, we have institutions as people who are trusted with the maintenance of the eBay marketplace. We've got laws. We've got law enforcement. We've got speech, you know, we've got – and the code, that's what Larry Lessig talks about. The right. code is the law in a sense, and we're in charge of the code. So, when you think about the institutions that we put in place to deal with the face-to-face world, one of those big institutions is the judicial system. And if you look at the types of disputes that we're engaging in this new cyber, in the internet, in this virtual world, this virtual country, the institutions we've built are almost entirely – mismatched. In the United States, if you are in Alabama and you try and offer legal advice in Mississippi, you could be disbarred, whereas the internet doesn't care about Alabama versus Mississippi. You can't have e-judges and e-jails and e-police. The whole system with sort of geographic boundaries and jurisdictions has no meaning in the internet context. Mm-hmm. So that's why CIS, what's everything that's going on at the Center for Internet Society, is so exciting. It's because now we're finally starting to wrestle with this. But I personally am of the opinion that online dispute resolution is going to have to be the foundation for whatever judicial institutions or conflict resolution institutions we build for the internet, because it is so boundaryless. It is so – jurisdiction is so meaningless in the online context. Mm-hmm. So, eBay almost entirely relies on dispute resolution, or what we call alternative dispute resolution, to deal with the problems that emerge, because – judicial systems are far too hidebound and connected to principles and rules and constructs that are meaningless online. So I don't want to get too wacky here, but I do think that what we're doing now, the problems that we're addressing at eBay, are the kinds of things that governments are going to have to address increasingly as people move more and more of their lives online, more and more of their emotional interactions, their business interactions, their creative interactions. So we're trying to build a good foundation here.
Well, I think, it's a fascinating area, and we're running short on time now. And it's something that I would like to invite you back to discuss more on a theoretical basis another time.
Sure.
It moves us right into that world that really we are starting to grapple with, and CIS is one of several entities that are trying to bring people together to do this. In my particular area of focus, I'm looking at secrecy and the impact of technology on people to simply keep information hidden, both from an intellectual property perspective, like trade secrets, but also from the operations of government. And what's increasingly clear as we look at this is that there's almost a misconception about technology as having as simply being a one-way street, that technology is going to inevitably move us in a direction where people will just find it a lot easier to hide things. And in the trade secret realm, now I don't want to move in an entirely different direction in the last minute we have, but the nutshell is that, in fact, when you deal with the internet, it's a whole different set of rules. And in fact, on the internet and with technology companies, it's actually a lot more difficult to keep a trade secret, because it's very easy to hit send on an email and just fire something out there or put it on the internet.
Absolutely.
That basic idea of whether it's easy or not to keep a secret undergirds a lot of what intellectual property law is about. And with technology changing that interaction, as it has in dispute resolution, we have to rethink these models. And so it's a great area, and I think while it's very abstract, it's also incredibly necessary. And so I look forward to having you back here again. In the last 20 seconds, I just want to give you an opportunity for people that want to read more about what you do.
Sure.
And also learn more about eBay's processes, just, any websites or any information you'd like to give.
Absolutely. Thanks. This is my plug, right?
This is the plug. Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you're interested in learning more about online dispute resolution, the best place to go is the Center for Information Technology and Dispute Resolution at UMass Amherst. And the website is odr.info. And it really is, it's an embarrassing wealth of information about ODR, far more than the average person is going to be interested in. But there's a blog there that tracks kind of recent developments in the field and all the upcoming conferences, and there's a digital library. So that's a great place to go. In terms of eBay, like you said, most people already know about it. I will put in a plug for ebaychatter.com, which is the eBay newsletter, and there's a great group of people at eBay who contribute to that blog. And I'm one of the contributors too, so that's a backhanded compliment
there
in itself.
There we go.
And then please, my last plug for my blog at the Center for Information, Internet and Society here at Stanford. I think Dave and I are two of the most active bloggers, and we may be the only two people reading each other's blogs. But,
well, that's one of the fun things about blogs, is that you can often meet the people that read your material.
Yes, definitely. But Dave, thank you very much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Colin, very much. I appreciate it, and it's been a great conversation. So we're going to take a short break, and then I'm going to come back and close the show. Steely Dan's only a fool would say that. Well, I want to thank Colin again for coming in today to discuss online dispute resolution. Hearsay Culture, my show here on KZSU, is going to be taking a brief hiatus for 3 weeks as I head out of town and will not have the wonderful studio at KZSU at Stanford to be my area to record shows. But I will be returning to the air in mid-August and look forward to having a great lineup of guests then. I encourage you to go to the CIS webpage, cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and check my blog where I will post some information about the show. I've also received emails from people asking if I'm going to set up a separate web page for the show, and I am in the process of doing that. So more information on that as it gets closer to fruition. But again, you've been listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. Please stay tuned for your imaginary friend. And thanks again, and we'll be in touch, and I'll be talking to you next month.